through the thick of them, bang as the bullets went through Bull's hat. We may all be killed, but we must kill a tidy number of them. I won't have it, said Dr. Bull, growing more vulgar in the sincerity of his virtue. The poor chaps may be making a mistake. Give the colonel a chance. Shall we go back then, asked the professor. No, said Ratcliffe in a cold voice. The street behind us is hell, too. In fact, I seem to see they're another friend of yours, Syme. Syme spun round smartly and stared back at the track which they had traveled. He saw an irregular body of horsemen gathering and galloping towards them in the gloom. He saw above the foremost saddle the silver gleam of a sword, and then, as it grew nearer, the silver gleam of an old man's hair. The next moment, with shattering violence, he had swung the motor round and sent it dashing down the steep side street to the sea, like a man that desired only to die. What the devil is up? Cried the professor, seizing his arm. The morning star has fallen, said Syme, as his own car went down the darkness, like a falling star. The others did not understand his words, but when they looked back at the street above, they saw the hostile cavalry coming round the corner and down the slopes after them. And foremost of all rode the good innkeeper, flushed with the fiery innocence of the evening light. The world is insane, said the professor, and buried his face in his hands. No, said Dr. Bull in adamantine humility. It is I. What are we going to do? Asked the professor. At this moment, said Syme with a scientific detachment, I think we are going to smash into a lamppost. The next instant, the automobile had come with a catastrophic jar against an iron object. The instant after that, four men had crawled out from under a chaos of metal, and a tall, lean lamppost that had stood up straight on the edge of the marine parade stood out, bent and twisted, like the branch of a broken tree. Well, we smashed something, said the professor with a faint smile. That's some comfort. You're becoming an anarchist, said Syme, dusting his clothes with his instinct of daintiness. Everyone is, said Ratcliffe. As they spoke, the white-haired horseman and his followers came thundering from above, and almost at the same moment a dark string of men ran shouting along the seafront. Syme snatched a sword and took it in his teeth. He stuck two others under his armpits, took a fourth in his left hand and the lantern in his right, and leaped off the high parade to the beach below. The others leaped after him with a common acceptance of such decisive action, leaving the debris and the gathering mob above them. We have one more chance, said Syme, taking the steel out of his mouth. Whatever all this pandemonium means, I suppose the police station will help us. We can't get there, for they hold the way. But there's a pier or breakwater runs out into the sea just here, where we could defend longer than anything else, like Horatius and his bridge. We must defend it till the gendarmerie turn out. Keep after me. They followed him as he went crunching down the beach, and in a second or two their boots broke, not on the sea gravel, but on broad, flat stones. They marched down a long, low jetty rutting out in one arm into the dim, boiling sea, and when they came to the end of it, they felt that they had come to the end of their story. They turned and faced the town. The town was transfigured with uproar. All along the high parade from which they had just descended was a dark and roaring stream of humanity, with tossing arms and fiery faces, groping and glaring towards them. The long, dark line was dotted with torches and lanterns, but even where no frame lit on a furious face, they could see the farthest figure in the most shadowy gesture and organized hate. It was clear that they were the accursed of all men, and they knew not why. Two or three men, looking a little and black like monkeys, leaped over the edge as they had done and dropped onto the beach. They came plowing down the deep sand, shouting horribly, and strove to wade into the sea at random. The example was followed, and the whole black mass of men began to run and drip over the edge like black treacle. Foremost among the men on the beach, Syme saw the peasant who had driven their cart. He splashed into the surf on a huge cart horse and shook his axe at them. The peasant cried, Syme, they have not risen since the Middle Ages. Even if the police do come now, said the professor mournfully, they can do nothing with this mob. Nonsense, said Bull desperately. There must be some people left in the town who are human. No, said the hopeless inspector, the human being will soon be extinct. We are the last of mankind. It may be, said the professor absently. Then he added in his dreamy voice, what is all that at the end of the Dunkiad? Nor public flame, nor private, dares to shine, nor human light is left, nor glimpse divine. Lo, thy dread empire, chaos, is restored. Light dies before thine uncreating word. Thy hand, great anarch, lets the curtain fall, and universal darkness buries all. Stop, cried Bull suddenly. The gendarmes are out. The low lights of the police station were indeed blotted and broken with hurrying figures, and they heard through the darkness the clash and jingle of a disciplined cavalry. They are charging the mob, cried Bull in ecstasy or alarm. No, said Syme, they are formed along the parade. They have unslung their carbines, cried Bull, dancing with excitement. Yes, said Ratcliffe, and they are going to fire on us. As he spoke, there came a long crackle of musketry, and bullets seemed to hop like hailstones on the stones in front of them. The gendarmes have joined them, cried the professor, and struck his forehead. I am in the padded cell, said Bull solidly. There was a long silence, and then Ratcliffe said, looking out over the swollen sea, all sort of gray-purple, what does it matter who is mad or who is sane? We shall all be dead soon. Syme turned to him and said, you are quite hopeless, then? Mr. Ratcliffe kept a stony silence. Then at last he said quietly, no, oddly enough, I am not quite hopeless. There is one insane little hope that I cannot get out of my mind. The power of this whole planet is against us, yet I cannot help wondering whether this one silly little hope is hopeless yet. In what or whom is your hope? Asked Syme with curiosity. In a man I never saw, said the other, looking at the leaden sea. I know what you mean, said Syme in a low voice, the man in the dark room. But Sunday must have killed him by now. Perhaps, said the other steadily, but if so, he was the only man whom Sunday found it hard to kill. I heard what you said, said the professor, with his back turned. I also am holding hard onto the thing I never saw. All of a sudden, Syme, who was standing as if blind with introspective thought, swung round and cried out like a man waking from sleep. Where is the colonel? I thought he was with us. The colonel? Yes, cried Bull. Where on earth is the colonel? He went to speak to Renard, said the professor. We cannot leave him among all those beasts, cried Syme. Let us die like gentlemen if... Do not pity the colonel, said Ratcliffe with a pale sneer. He is extremely comfortable. He is... No, 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 cried Syme in a kind of frenzy. Not the colonel, too. I will never believe it. Will you believe your eyes? Asked the other and pointed to the beach. Many of their pursuers had waded into the water, shaking their fists, but the sea was rough and they could not reach the pier. Two or three figures, however, stood on the beginning of the stone footway and seemed to be cautiously advancing down it. The glare of a chance lantern lit up the faces of the two foremost. One face wore a black half-mask, and under it the mouth was twisting about in such a madness of nerves that the black tuft of beard wriggled round and around like a restless living thing. The other was the red face and white mustache of Colonel Ducroy. They were in earnest consultation. Yes, he is gone too, said the professor and sat down on a stone. Everything's gone. I'm gone. I can't trust my own bodily machinery. I feel as if my own hand might fly up and strike me. When my hand flies up, said Syme, it will strike somebody else, and he strode along the pier toward the colonel, the sword in one hand and the lantern in the other. As if to destroy the last hope or doubt, the colonel, who saw him coming, pointed his revolver at him and fired. The shot missed Syme but struck his sword, breaking it short at the hilt. Syme rushed on and swung the iron lantern above his head. Judas before Herod, he said, and struck the colonel down upon the stones. Then he turned to the secretary, whose frightful mouth was almost foaming now, and held the lamp high with so rigid and arresting a gesture that the man was, as it were, frozen for a moment and forced to hear. "Do you see this lantern?" cried Simon in a terrible voice. Do you see the cross carved on it and the flame inside? You did not make it. You did not light it. Better men than you, men who could believe and obey, twisted the entrails of iron and preserved the legend of fire. There is not a street you walk on, there is not a thread you wear that was not made as this lantern was, by denying your philosophy of dirt and rats. You can make nothing. You can only destroy. You will destroy mankind. You will destroy the world. Let that suffice you.
Yep.
Yet this one old Christian lantern you shall not destroy. It shall go where your empire of apes will never have the wit to find it. He struck the secretary once with the lantern so that he staggered, and then, whirling it twice round his head, sent it flying far out to sea, where it flared like a roaring rocket and fell. "Swords!" shouted Syme, turning his flaming face to the three behind him. "Let us charge these dogs, for our time has come to die." His three companions came after him, sword in hand. Syme's sword was broken, but he rent a bludgeon from the fist of a fisherman, flinging him down. In a moment they would have flung themselves upon the face of the mob and perished, when an interruption came. The secretary, ever since Syme's speech, had stood with his hand in his stricken head, as if dazed. Now he suddenly pulled off his black mask. The pale face, thus peeled in the lamplight, revealed not so much rage as astonishment. He put up his hand with an anxious authority. "There is some mistake," he said. "Mr. Syme, I hardly think you understand your position. I arrest you in the name of the law." "Of the law?" said Syme, and dropped his stick. "Certainly," said the secretary. "I am a detective from Scotland Yard," and he took a small blue card from his pocket. "And what do you suppose we are?" asked the professor, and threw up his arms. "You," said the secretary stiffly, "are, as I know for a fact, members of the Supreme Anarchist Council. Disguised as one of you, I..." Dr. Bull tossed his sword into the sea. "There never was any Supreme Anarchist Council," he said. "We were all a lot of silly policemen looking at each other, and all these nice people who have been peppering us with shot thought we were the dynamiters. I knew I couldn't be wrong about that mob," he said, beaming over the enormous multitude which stretched away to the distance on both sides. "Vulgar people are never mad. I'm vulgar myself, and I know. I am now going on shore to stand a drink to everybody here." Chapter 13. The Pursuit of the President. Next morning, five bewildered but hilarious people took the boat for Dover. The poor old colonel might have had some cause to complain, having been first forced to fight for two factions that didn't exist, and then knocked down with an iron lantern. But he was a magnanimous old gentleman, and being much relieved that neither party had anything to do with dynamite, he saw them off on the pier with great geniality. The five reconciled detectives had 100 details to explain to each other. The secretary had to tell Syme how they had come to wear masks originally in order to approach the supposed enemy as fellow conspirators. Syme had to explain how they had fled with such swiftness through a civilized country. But above all these matters of detail which could be explained rose the central mountain of the matter that they could not explain. What did it all mean? If they were all harmless officers, what was Sunday? If he had not seized the world, what on earth had he been up to? Inspector Ratcliffe was still gloomy about this. "I can't make head or tail of old Sunday's little game any more than you can," he said. "But whatever else Sunday is, he isn't a blameless citizen. Damn it, do you remember his face?" "I grant you," answered Syme, "that I have never been able to forget it." "Well," said the secretary, "I suppose we can find out soon, for tomorrow we have our next general meeting." "You will excuse me," he said with a rather ghastly smile, "for being well acquainted with my secretarial duties." "I suppose you are right," said the professor reflectively. "I suppose we might find it out from him, but I confess that I should feel a bit afraid of asking Sunday who he really is." "Why?" asked the secretary, "for fear of bombs?" "No," said the professor, "for fear he might tell me." "Let us have some drinks," said Dr. Blow after a silence. Throughout their whole journey by boat and train, they were highly convivial, but they instinctively kept together. Dr. Bull, who had always been the optimist of the party, endeavored to persuade the other four that the whole company could take the same hansom cab from Victoria. But this was overruled, and they went in a four-wheeler, with Dr. Bull on the box singing. They finished their journey at a hotel in Piccadilly Circus, so as to be close to the early breakfast next morning in Leicester Square. Yet even then, the adventures of the day were not entirely over. Dr. Bull, discontented with a general purpose to go to bed, had strolled out of the hotel at about 11 to see and taste some of the beauties of London. 20 minutes afterwards, however, he came back and made quite a clamor in the hall. Syme, who tried at first to soothe him, was forced at last to listen to his communication with quite new attention. "I tell you I've seen him," said Dr. Bull with thick emphasis. "Whom?" asked Syme quickly. "Not the president." "Not so bad as that," said Dr. Bull with unnecessary laughter. "Not so bad as that. I've got him here." "Got whom here?" said Syme impatiently. "Harry, ma'am," said the other lucidly. "Man that used to be Harry, Gogol. Here he is," and he pulled forward by a reluctant elbow the identical young man who 5 days before had marched out of the council with thin red hair and a pale face, the first of all the sham anarchists who had been exposed. "Why do you worry with me?" he cried. "You have expelled me as a spy." "We are all spies," whispered Syme. "We're all spies," shouted Dr. Bull. "Come and have a drink." Next morning, the battalion of the reunited six marched stolidly toward the hotel in Leicester Square. "This is more cheerful," said Dr. Bull. "We are six men going to ask one man what he means." "I think it a bit queerer than that," said Syme. "I think it is six men going to ask one man what they mean." They turned in silence into the square, and though the hotel was in the opposite corner, they saw at once the little balcony and a figure that looked too big for it. He was sitting alone with bent head, poring over a newspaper. But all his counselors who had come to vote him down crossed that square as if they were watched out of heaven by 100 eyes. They had disputed much upon their policy about whether they should leave the unmasked Gogol without and begin diplomatically, or whether they should bring him in and blow up the gunpowder at once. The influence of Simon Bolt prevailed for the latter course, though the secretary to the last asked them why they attacked Sunday so rashly. "My reason is quite simple," said Syme. "I attack him rashly because I am afraid of him." They followed Syme up the dark stair in silence, and they all came out simultaneously into the broad sunlight of the morning and the broad sunlight of Sunday's smile. "Delightful," he said. "So pleased to see you all. What an exquisite day it is. Is the Tsar dead?" The secretary, who happened to be foremost, drew himself together in a dignified outburst. "No, sir," he said sternly, "there has been no massacre. I bring you news of no such disgusting spectacles." "Disgusting spectacles," repeated the president with a bright, inquiring smile. "You mean Dr. Bull's spectacles?" The secretary choked for a moment, and the president went on with a sort of smooth appeal. "Of course, we all have our opinions and even our eyes, but really to call him disgusting before the man himself." Dr. Bull tore off his spectacles and broke them on the table. "My spectacles are blackguardly," he said, "but I am not. Look at my face." "I dare say it's the sort of face that grows on one," said the president. "In fact, it grows on you, and who am I to quarrel with the wild fruits upon the tree of life? I dare say it will grow on me some day." "We have no time for tomfoolery," said the secretary, breaking in savagely. "We have come to know what all this means. Who are you? What are you? Why did you get us all here? Do you know who and what we are? Are you a half-witted man playing the conspirator, or are you a clever man playing the fool? Answer me, I tell you." "Candidates," murmured Sunday, "are only required to answer 8 out of the 17 questions on the paper. As far as I can make out, you want me to tell you what I am and what you are and what this table is and what this council is and what this world is for all I know. Well, I will go so far as to rend the veil of one mystery. If you want to know what you are a set of highly well-intentioned young jackasses." "And you," said Syme, leaning forward, "what are you?" "I? What am I?" roared the president. and he rose slowly to an incredible height like some enormous wave about to arch above them and break. "You want to know what I am, do you? Bull, you are a man of science. Grub in the roots of those trees and find out the truth about them. Sime, you